My friends, you must be delighted and challenged but exhausted. Stay with me a little longer because I want to tell you about my father. He was born the day before the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and he lived with his parents and his brother in a tiny terrace in Woolwich, not far from the Royal Arsenal, where they were manufacturing armaments to destroy the bodies of boys and men. When my father was perhaps 13, one of his neighbours took a fondness to him. This neighbour was sometimes heard raving in the night through bouts of malaria. He claimed to have played the trumpet at Glyndebourne. He said that he had been flogged at the mainmast on one of the clippers that sailed for Australia. And for reasons none of us can understand, he really liked my clever, ragged, working-class, undernourished dad who left school at 14. And when my dad was 13, he gave him a book called Castle's Book of Sports and Pastimes. And on page 464 of almost 1,000, my father came across some words that changed the trajectory of his life and in due course changed mine. He read this: "You may make a very good and serviceable telescope for astronomical purposes at very small cost, for you only require a couple of lenses and some suitable tubing to place them in." Entirely undaunted, my father was given a chipped magnifying glass by his neighbour, and he begged and stole a broken pair of reading glasses, and he made a tube out of rolled-up magazines fastened with sellotape, and he went out at night, and he saw the shining, dry seas of the moon rolling over South London. I don't have time to tell you now about all the telescopes my father made and tried to make during his youth and well into the years of when I was in my 20s. Although I should tell you that he once went down to Chatham Docks where they were dismantling the warships that were decommissioned after the Second World War. And he found a stack of portholes of very cheap, poor quality, slightly green glass. And he took it home and he made something called a pitch lap and used a substance called iron oxide to try to grind a porthole of a ship into a lens for a large telescope. He was at this for weeks and weeks and weeks in a cupboard under the stairs, and eventually he went out to test it, but he had failed to carve this convex lens into the perfect parabola of a sphere. So when he used it to look at the moon was distorted and ugly. So he returned to his book of instructions to find out what you should do with the lens to which this has happened, and it said you must take the lens, pick it up very carefully, and throw it at a lamppost. This love he had for the stars stayed with him all his life, and it has infected me until on the 11th of April in 1986, in the back garden of my childhood home in Essex, I stood with him and held his hand, and I saw Halley's Comet. This comet is, of course, the best known of all the comets. The earliest record of it is in the Records of the Great Historian, which is a Chinese historical record from 240 BC. It's so well known because its orbital period is only 76 years, so it punctuates the long sentence of our history. You will find it in a Giotto painting of the Nativity. You'll find it on the bio tapestry. It's mentioned in War and Peace. I was 6 years old, and this is what I remember of Comet Halley, and with total lucidity, as if it was just last night, I can remember the white metal optical tube of my father's Newtonian telescope, which by that time he'd been able to purchase, so it worked. I can remember the feel of the long, wet grass on my bare legs in my dressing gown, and I can remember the covering cloud. But I remember the cloud receding and the first stars coming out, and then, as if I'd longed it into being, the comet hanging apparently motionless above the garden shed. It has been imprinted on my vision ever since. It was a kind of radiant, pearly smear, no longer than the size of the finger, my little fingernail, if I were to hold out my arm extended, fanned out from a very faintly shining nucleus like a large star, its dust tail streaming in the solar winds. And my dad said, "It's just a dirty snowball, it's just a dirty snowball." But he saw it with wonder, and so did I. the matter of our bodies, the rods and cones in our eyes, the neurotransmitters in our brains, the sudden dump of adrenaline that caused all the goosebumps to go up on my arms and the hairs on the back of my neck to stand up, responded with helpless joy to an inert, cold rock hurtling past, totally indifferent, 39 million miles away. This sensation has been observed and anatomized and studied in various kinds of ways. I often think of it as the sublime, which is that encounter with the beautiful so overwhelming it more nearly approaches terror. But lately, because I'm afraid I have also inherited from my father a love of Calvin, I have come to think of it as an act of grace. As I've drifted down my own orbit, away from the evangelical Christianity in which I was brought up, and I try to work out my own salvation with fear and trembling, I come again and again to the idea of grace. It has a very particular meaning in Reformation theology, but we are not in a church, and mercifully for you all, I am not in a pulpit. So we will deal not with Reformation idea of grace, but rather the idea of common grace. And this is thought of as undeserved favour, extended to us all, found in moments of communion with what is most beautiful and what is most extraordinary, and that you can never earn or deserve. It is an utter gift, so that, as Wordsworth said, we are surprised by joy. Theologians speak of available grace. It is available to us all. It arrives as a gift entirely free, entirely unsought, and importantly, regardless of the condition of your conscience or your soul. John Bunyan's memoir was called Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, and he was talking about Apostle Paul's line where he said, where sin abounds, grace does much more abound. And we can think of how when we're at our most degraded and our most low and our most shamed, that might be when the grace of looking at a rising moon is most profound and most deep. I said I wasn't going to be in a pulpit, but I can't resist a tiny bit of theology, which is this. This gives rise to a heresy called antinomianism, and it suggests that in order to find out how much God loves you, you should sin as much as possible. So if any of you were thinking of sinning this evening, you can characterise it as a sort of act of, you know, spiritual endeavour, and God bless you all. Grace is available, and it is called irresistible. It is essential to the full flourishing of our lives, and we cannot withstand the need. In fact, the miraculous absurdity of our being here at all, summoned so briefly out of nothing, can be conceived of as an act of grace. The poet W.S. Graham wrote this: "Within all the dead of all my life, I hear my name spoken on the break of the surf. I, in time's grace, the grace of change, am cast into memory. What a restless grace to trace stillness on." That moment with my father in the back garden in 1986 has genuinely become one of the organising principles of my life. I only want to live to be 82 so that I can see Hallie again. I carry it with me always. I have an engraving of Hallie on my ribs underneath my heart. And in October this year and every year, we will see the Orionids, a shower of meteors coming from the region of Orion, caused by the Earth's orbit moving through the belt of rubble and detritus left behind by Halley. It is like hearing the comet's echo or the memory of a comet. As we all know, the memory of an event is very often brighter and more lovely than the thing itself. A year or so ago, as I sat with my father at the kitchen table drawing Kepler's laws on scraps of paper, I said to my dad, "Dad, do you remember when we went out into the garden and I held your hand and we saw Halley's Comet?" And he said, "Oh, Sarah, no, we didn't. There was total cloud cover. The comet had settled on the further side of the sun, and it was the worst seeing conditions for 2,000 years. In my mind, I had conflated Halley with Comet Hale-Bopp, the great comet of 1997. And so it turned out that this great love of mine that had been so profound and so altering and so generative had all been predicated on a misunderstanding. But all the same, I did feel that grace. I have my own telescope now. It's the kind of telescope my 13-year-old father could never have dreamed of. He came with me to help me buy it, and I seem to recall laughed almost the entire time. It's an 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope with a GPS system containing the Messier catalogues and the star catalogues. And with it, standing in my little city back garden with the aeroplanes and the Starlink satellites passing over, I have seen such wonders. I have seen sharp shadows falling on the sunlit craters of the moon. I have seen the Cassini gap in the rings of Saturn, and I have seen the shadow cast on the body of the planet by those rings. I have seen the ice poles on Mars and the opalescent bloom on the lens, which is the Orion Nebula where stars are being born. And a month or so ago, to my utter childish joy, I photographed a storm on the surface of the sun. I bought this telescope at the beginning of the pandemic, and at that time I had a heart like a dropped plate, cracked all over. And this is what I discovered. Using a telescope does not bring the moon and stars down. It's a question of flight. Night after night, in these extraordinarily clear seeing conditions brought about by a bout of good weather and grounded aeroplanes, I stood until I was so cold my hands could no longer operate the focus wheel, but I never cared. I had become unmoored from the anchor of gravity, and all the sadness I felt and the boredom and the confusion and the fear caused by COVID dwindled down to nothing behind me. I became possessed. I attempted to teach myself A-level physics, hampered only by the fact that if I am required to count any higher than 10, I have to take my socks off. The more I learned of the motion of bodies in orbit, the larger and more astounding the world became. For example, I learnt that space is not silent, it is singing. You should never think that just because you hear nothing, nothing is being said. I often have in mind the words of Christ as he prepared to enter Jerusalem. Even the stones cry out in praise. And so it is for the planets. It is possible to treat the radio waves constantly being emitted by the planets and approximate how they might sound if they fell within the range of human hearing and there were sufficient particles in the atmosphere to cause mechanical sound waves. And I have listened over and over again. Neptune sounds like waves crashing on a shingle beach while the wind blows through an abandoned structure in the distance. Jupiter's diligent, loyal little moon Io sounds like an orchestra tuning up in the pit just before the curtain rises. And Earth sounds to me like a flock of small birds startled by a passing train. I've also learned, with my father's help and my mother, who's mercifully a maths teacher and makes up for my lack, the laws of planetary motion as set out by Kepler. Kepler wrote this: I demonstrate, by means of philosophy, that the Earth is round and inhabited on all sides, that it is insignificantly small and borne through stars. First, Kepler teaches us this, and I hold Kepler's laws very close to me as a kind of parable. A planet's orbit is not a circle, but an ellipse, with the sun as one of the two foci. The other focus is nothing. It is a mathematical necessity. There is nothing there. So we may know our suns. We can look to what is the shining motive force that drives us down our orbits. But there's an absence too, just as essential to how we move. The second law, and you may believe me or not as you choose, but to my great shame, it's absolutely true, is so beautiful to me that when I finally drew it and calculated and realized I understood, I cried. And the second law of Kepler says this: the semi-major axis sweeps out equal areas in equal time. And if you were to sit down with a pen and paper and work it out, you would learn this. What it means is that a body in orbit moves faster and faster as it approaches the sun, like a woman rushing towards her lover. And then as it passes the sun, it gets slower and slower as it goes into the dark until the full transit begins again, which I take as an enormous consolation when thinking about the varieties in the passing of love. Although, depressingly, you should know that there are some comets that have sufficient energy to have a parabolic orbit. So they sweep around the sun and disappear into the dark, just as some loves come blazing towards us and then drift and drift and are never seen again. Kepler's third law is called the law of harmonies. And it states this, that these calculations hold true for all the planetary bodies. And there's a great consolation to me here. How can we be lonely, understanding as we must surely do, that there is no force moving us that hasn't moved others? I will be 44 this year. I am more than halfway home to Hayley. I'm nearing the end of my fourth novel and my fifth book, and I've come to understand that the acquisition of knowledge done well is humbling. My schoolboy study of physics has left me with more wonder, not less. The thought that comes to mind most often as I think about God and physics and love is, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. But very tentatively, I move towards the idea that it is grace that constitutes our law of harmonies. That if you and I were to go out this evening and see a comet rising over King's Cross, the common matter of our bodies would respond with helpless joy. So what can I say as we come to the end of this extraordinary day? What do we hold in common, being what we are? Insignificantly small and born through stars. I don't know. I don't know. I only know that soon enough, offered freely, unasked and undeserved, and coming by surprise, we will be moved by a rising moon, or the passage of the year's first exhausted swift, or by Venus rising at dawn. Perhaps it's grace that brought us safe this far, and grace will bring us home. I just want to finish with some lines from R.S. Thomas, such an austere and difficult man that they said of his poetry, out of the strong came forth sweetness. And he said this, there are two hungers, hunger for bread and hunger of the uncouth soul for the light's grace.